So what I notice is that I'm more conscious of the inner critic in my own process, and that becomes some of my material. And I was just sitting, and I'm just using this as an example, sharing this sort of bit of a personal example with you, just to give you a flavour of how I relate to meditation and how I relate to the model of the inner critic and bring the two together. So my personality, I'm actually naturally quite a shy person. So even though I've been teaching for many years, sitting at the front, being the one who's showing up more and revealed more, goes against the grain for me. I just probably wouldn't do it. I just do it for various reasons. And so it brings up a certain degree of nervousness and uneasiness for me. And the basic orientation of my practice is simply to allow what's here to just be what it is. So the reactive response to that nervousness is to try and fix it some way, to try and amend it. But I've learned over the years in my experience in meditation, if something's here, it's here for a reason. Things arise due to past causes. And in order to fully understand what's needed, I need to allow what's here to be here. I need to allow it to manifest, in a sense. I need to allow that feeling in the body, the mental feeling, even the narrative. And something just initially happens just by that allowing, and then sort of acknowledging, okay, it feels this way. Okay, this is what I'm telling myself right now. And when I tell myself this, this is the resonant effect on the feelings in my body and my mind. And there's a sort of, I was just noticing as I was sitting with those feelings, which kind of been coming and going a bit as I approach any retreat, actually I approach this day, last night, this morning, the last few days, those feelings have been coming and going. And as I just meet them and allow them, it brings a kind of, they're there, but there's also a sense of space there. And I realise that's that nervousness or that uneasiness, it's not the totality of reality. It's like a part of the picture. I'm not following it, I'm not trying to get rid of it, it's just what it is. It's just. And then I start to notice what else is here. So like just as I was sitting, I was noticing a kind of the presence of you, actually. So you are, some of you know each other, most of you probably don't know each other, but just by arriving and I guess some of you tune just to sitting quietly and connecting with yourselves as well, something happens in the space. Makes sense as I talk. So I started to connect to that. So one of my teachers said, and I really like this as an orientation to practice, that meditation is actually a very natural part of us. Sometimes it can become... Can you all hear me clearly enough, by the way? Yeah. Sometimes it can become something that feels very refined or specialist. But I like to describe it and relate to it as something very innate, very natural to us. In the sense of the stillness of it. So I sometimes use this image because I think images are quite helpful for getting a sense of things, of like a pool in the forest and lots of leaves fall into the pool, and it's like our minds, like if we put our hands into that pool, we stirred up the silt from the bottom, and so the water becomes murky with all the silt and the leaves. And that's basically what it's like with our minds in our usual on a level of mind where we can often be operating, which is on the level of our conditioning and our reactions, our likes and our dislikes, the way we think things should be or ought to be, and how we maneuver and move through life in reference to those things, actually involves a lot of moving away from, moving towards, trying to hold on. There can be quite a lot of doing in that. And meditation, one of the things we do, and I feel the effect of simply one of the effects of meditation is simplicity. We simply have less going on. We're sitting in a room, we're not, we're kind of more turning our attention inwards, so we're less engaged outwardly, we're not moving out so much. And that naturally reduces quite a lot of that activity. And it's almost like, what's it like when we take our hands out of the pool? The mind naturally, the water, the silt starts to settle. And the natural fundamental state of the mind is this clearness and this stillness. But we're often not in touch with that because the activity, until we see how the activity engages us, it keeps running. So I'm also very interested in what puts the hands in the water and moves them around. So meditation is this meeting our experience in the moment, meeting that activity in the moment. And the model or the framework of the inner critic from psychodynamic understanding is a framework, a kind of reference point for understanding that activity in the here and now moment. So that's my interest. That's what I'd like to share with you today, my process and contemplation, bringing those two understandings together. So I'd like to now speak to the experience of the inner critic. So I'm imagining, I'm guessing as you were doing this meditation and bringing in this suggestion of allowing and opening, that there may be in some things where there was some sort of resistance to that, or some sort of not an opening response to that suggestion in the mind. Is that true? Is that what your experience? So there's some innate sense that some things are not okay, some things are unacceptable. So in terms of the Buddha's perspective on experience, as I understand it, a sort of principle that I've sort of been sharing with you this morning, in a sense, is that everything belongs because everything is just as it is. In a sense, everything has its own nature. So sometimes I use this analogy or image of like weather systems. So we're sitting and it's almost like different weather systems pass through. Sometimes we feel stormy, sometimes we feel, you know, that when that feeling when it's about to rain but isn't raining, that density. I mean, I don't think the weather covers all the ranges of our inner experience, but just, it's like anger has its own nature, has its own causes, has its own things that fuel it, and the certain conditions that free it up. Joy has its own nature, it has its own causes, it has its the qualities that bring it forth and sustain it, and things that cause it to pass. So one of my teachers, he used to say, everything is nature happening. So all the thoughts, feelings, experiences in our body. And we don't usually see it like that. We more see it like it's who I am and what I'm doing and my success or failure or right or wrongness. But one of the things I like to think about actually is the Buddha described the feelings and mind states we experience now to people 2,500 years ago in Middle India. So there's something about these things have their reality or they're true to the nature of those people then as they are to us now. And so one of these kind of the effects of just allowing what's here is as something arises within us, it sort of has a certain movement to it. And if we just allow it to have the movement it's having without following it or rejecting it, it just tends to move through, like weather. So for instance, with anger, if I don't make the anger wrong, and in terms of the precepts, I have the principle of not just acting out my anger, but that does, so I can both not act it out and fully allow it. That's possible. So the feeling in my body of being triggered and reactive, the turmoil, the sensations of that, the mental feeling of that, I can contemplate in the moment. It takes a bit of practice. It takes a bit of coming into presence with it. And I can notice the interrelationship between that feeling, that unpleasant feeling, and what's going on in my mind. As I become more present to it, I'll ask myself, what am I telling myself right now? Just to bring forth the thinking level. Because often it's the narrative that is the key fueling point for the whole arising of this experience. It's not to deny that things don't impact us, and anger a lot, in fact, is about setting a boundary. It's about, inherent in it is a no. That's enough so far, you know. But we don't often feel it at that simple level. It gets lost in our perceptions about ourselves or the situation, how it should be. It gets lost in the proliferation of the reaction. But if I don't reject the anger and I come to meet it, and it's almost as if it's experiencing the movement of all that reactivity, the movement in the body sensations and the mental feeling. And how that movement is sparked by the beliefs and assumptions and perceptions the mind is running with. So they did that deliberately. They're not respecting me, you know, or and then what happens as I notice and make conscious those thoughts. In the moment, I can. It's almost like there can be a bit of a reality check about what's real now, what's true now. Because a lot of our reactivity is formed from our past, from our history. So we see things through a certain filter, if you like, of our history overlaying the present. So when I make those thoughts more conscious, there can almost be a slight check of knowing, well, this may not be about now. This may not be about this person, or this person's actually reminding me of my brother, this is a familiar reaction for me. I know that when someone looks at me this way or speaks to me this way, this is how I feel. I feel rejected, or I feel made wrong, or so I start to be able to discern a bit more what may be relevant now and what may be a sort of sense of an overlay from a familiar sense of a way of being. Does this make sense as I say this? Is this so? What I'd like to speak to a bit now is the understanding I have of where the inner critic arises in our history. And the reason I'm very interested in psychodynamic understanding, and I'd like to say I am not an expert in this, I have a very rudimentary understanding that I use as a tool for contemplation. The reason I like to refer to psychodynamic understanding because I feel it is, in a sense, a wisdom that's arisen in our recent history as a response to our conditioning as people now. So although I mentioned earlier that the Buddha described mind states and experiences to people 2,500 years ago that correlate to our current experience, I also feel it's true that we are dealing with different ways we've been impressed and impacted by our environment. So, for instance, a much higher level of complexity, I think, than perhaps 2,500 years ago in Middle India. I'm just assuming, but I feel that psychodynamic understanding is a wisdom that has been a response to our current condition. That's why I'm interested in bringing the two together. So, I'd just like to read you something. Personal history with the formation of the inner critic. So as I read this, I'd just like you to continue just to stay in touch with yourself and just see how what I say lands with you. You don't have to believe it, or anything I say actually, you don't have to believe or disbelieve, but just see how it resonates with you. As a child, our parents had to discipline us and show us how to be in society. They did the best they could, often out of a sense of love, but inevitably through the filters of their own conditioning. For a child, it is its emotions and feelings. So when these are disapproved of, or they sense they are disapproved of, the child feels itself to be disapproved of and rejected. A child can't separate the two, the sense of self and the behaviour or feeling experience. However, as adults, we have more capacity to be objective about our feelings and behaviours. It's a bit more possible to separate the two. So as children, we internalised standards of right and wrong from our parents and society. Then this constellated as what is referred to as the inner critic. And that inner critic, by using guilt and shame, urged us to behave and act appropriately according to the moral code we learned. As a child, you had to learn what was required from you in order to experience being liked and accepted. There were certain aspects of you that were seen, that felt seen and appreciated by your parents. For instance, your intelligence, your attractiveness, your success at school or not, your sweetness, your obedience, your determination. I mean, the list could be very long about the nuances about what felt to be acceptable or unacceptable and right and wrong. And these became what you believed you should be. The judge then served the survival needs of the child by being a key component of that inner suppression, through shame and blame, motivating the child to avoid acting in certain ways that would cause, it believed would cause rejection. And through praise, encouraging him or her to act in ways that would, it believed would bring acceptance. There's an unavoidable journey of development we all go through. It's interesting that the Buddha, I think this is true, that the Buddha didn't say it was possible to become enlightened the youngest age. It was possible at the time the Buddha was 7. So there needed to be some discriminative understanding of the sense of self, some maturational experience of that sense of self, in order to go beyond it. So although striving in this way as a child may have brought parental approval or societal approval, it did little to give inner peace, because of the ongoing inner pressure to be a certain way. So I realise, I don't know, this may impact you in different ways, quite sensitive. I know when I first heard this, it was quite sensitive. So I'd like to share with you some senses of how that might translate into how the inner critic continues to play out in our lives now in a number of ways by giving you some vignettes or examples of that way the inner critic can show up in our lives now. So again, as I read this, just stay with your bodies and feelings and sense of resonance with what I'm saying. So one way the inner critic can show up for some of us is as a kind of perfectionist, a position of perfectionist. So this critic puts pressure on us to do things perfectly. It is a running commentary, can feel like or be experienced as a running commentary on everything you do. How you brush your hair, your teeth, do your hair, wash dishes, make the bed, as you move through your day, how you dress, getting dressed, how you work, how you're doing your work, how your desk looks, whatever. And it sets high standards for the things you, how you appear, what you produce, how you function, and how you perform. It has difficulty saying something is complete or good enough. It tries to make sure that you fit in and that you will not be judged or rejected. And its expectations probably reflect those of people who have been significant or important to you, that you've looked up to, that you want to approval from. So one of the reasons why it's sensitive to attend to the inner critic is it's a very painful part of our conditioning. One of the reasons I'm motivated to teach it is that I know how much suffering it causes. Every single retreat I teach, people, it would come up. And one reason I turn attention directly to it is I wanted to give more support with understanding this piece of conditioning. So I'm offering these, one thing that brings separation is being able to discriminate out and discern our experience, to acknowledge it and know it for what it is. So sometimes just the naming of something. So for instance, with the mental feeling I've referred to earlier, I'll notice, oh, this is the inner critic having a go. You know, pushing me to an impossible expectation of getting it right. So I had the perfectionist coming in with teaching this. So I've got to get it absolutely right for everybody. So that's an important, that's just not within my control, is it? So that's the suffering, the inner critic. When we're hooked by it, it's hooking us into failing, essentially, because that's impossible. So the next one, is also one I'm very susceptible to, it's the guilt tripper. So of course these are a bit cliches, the way I'm framing this, but they're just to give some way of discriminating out this conditioning. So the guilt tripper, this critic is stuck in the past. It is unable to forgive you for wrongs you have done or people you have hurt. It is concerned about relationships and holds you to standards of behaviour prescribed by your community, culture, and family. It tries to protect you from repeating past mistakes by making sure you never forget or feel free. And the paradox of these things is the guilt trip doesn't actually help you function more effectively or be more sensitive, because it's a very insensitive way of relating to ourselves. Often keeps us very busy with trying to prepare or control our behaviour so that we can lose sensitivity to being in the moment and responding. And the truth is, we learn from being allowed to make mistakes just like children do. So the underminer, five more. Okay, so the underminer, this critic tries to undermine your self-confidence and self-esteem so that you won't take risks. It makes direct attacks on your self-worth so that you will stay small and not take chances where you could get hurt and rejected. Keep your head below the parapet. You know, don't say what you really feel in the meeting, you know. It is afraid of being too big or too visible and not being able to tolerate judgment or failure, what it perceives to be judgment or failure. So these were all ways or strategies we learned as children that we may carry over into our lives now. So the next one is called the destroyer. This one is very sort of aggressive attacks on our fundamental self-worth. It's sort of shames you and makes you feel inherently flawed just for existing, basically, and not entitled to basic understanding or respect. This most debilitating critic comes from early life deprivation or trauma. It is motivated by a belief that it is safer not to exist. The next one is the conformist. This critic tries to get you to fit into a certain mould based on standards held by society, your culture, or your family. It wants you to be liked and admired and to protect you from being abandoned, shamed, or rejected. The conformist fears that the rebel or the free spirit in you would act in ways that are unacceptable. So it keeps you from being in touch with and expressing your nature. Two more. The taskmaster. So this critic wants you to work hard and be successful. Its orientation is that you may be mediocre or lazy and will be judged a failure if it does not push you to keep going. Its pushing often activates a procrastinator or rebel that fights against its harsh dictates. So the final one, it's called the inner controller. This critic tries to control your impulses, so basic instincts, around eating, drinking, sexual activity, For instance, it shows up as a watchfulness you have over yourself in social situations, to make sure you stay within certain parameters, don't do anything foolish or inappropriate or attract attention. It is polarized with an indulger part that it fears can get out of control at any moment. It tends to be harsh and shaming in an effort to protect you from these activities, it says, are wrong. It is motivated to try to make you a good person who is accepted and functions well in society. So I realise that's quite a lot to take in. And so do any of those feel familiar in any way? Can you connect? I think we all have a bit of all of them at different times. And the ways we get caught by that narrative in our minds, the beliefs and assumptions and identifications within it. Because that need to belong and be accepted is very, very deep, and is true. We are social beings, relational beings. But often, so what I've found useful about deeply inquiring into the inner critic in the moment as it arises is I then have the opportunity to discover what's true now. That's what worked as a child. That's what was needed, in a sense. And in allowing it to become more visible in the moment, I start to see what is perhaps now a limiting and unhelpful way of in making those narratives more conscious, I discover what's real. I start to discover what's more real, what's real and true about them now or not. So before we go into the exercise, I'd just like to share an experience with you, just to give you, just to put this into context a bit with the practice. Just check the time. But before I do that, actually, is everybody okay? Are you all right enough with... You're right. Good. Good. So, basically, this thing I'm going to share with you, experience in my practice a few years ago, is just to give, again, the sense of the value of not rejecting what we are socialized to usually reject, the value of not doing that. So, as a nun, for many, many years, for most of my nun's life, I lived with this other nun. I lived with many other nuns, but I had a particular issue with this one nun. And basically, my issue was jealousy. I was really jealous of her. And it was in particular relationship to one of the senior monks I was very attached to, who I perceived was more fond of her than he was of me, or more responsive to her than he was of me. And this jealousy went on for years. So come and go, obviously, be triggered by certain... I'd see a certain interaction and then up it would come. And for many years, I just tried to fix it or get rid of it. It was wrong. Buddhist, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a nun. I don't want to be jealous, and I certainly don't want other people to know I'm jealous. I do not want that perception of self going on in other people's minds. And then one day, we used to do these all-night sits in the monastery every week. And they were great, actually, great practice. Hard, but useful. Because you had to sort of stay with some whatever was coming up for you for the long haul in those sits. And so she was sitting next to me. I don't want you to work out who she was, actually, but anyway. She was sitting next to me. And the monk that I was attached to, he was giving a talk. And there was a moment in that talk when I saw him make eye contact with her. And then I got this wave of jealousy, wave of reactivity, and the pain that goes with that come up. So he just finished the talk, and then we go into a meditation period. And I was just doing really exactly what I've shared with you so far today. I was asking myself, can I let this be here? Can I just... So I was exploring, you know, being present, being with, allowing. And at a certain point, just by acknowledging and recognizing the criticism, the inner critic rejection of that state, there's something about the effect of acknowledging something, it loses a hold on the mind. And eventually a space opened up where I could just let the jealousy be there and not make it wrong. I actually recognised the effect of making it wrong. It didn't help, didn't work. You know, even if technically we could all agree that jealousy is not a good thing, making it bad and wrong and trying to get rid of it, it just doesn't work. And I sort of open to it. And as in that moment, what it became, it shifted to being a pain in my heart. And as I was with that, I became in touch with the sort of sense of sadness and longing. So instead of judgment and rejection, there was sort of connection, and then this quality of this kind of wishing to know, which is a kind of curiosity. Wishing to know what's true about this, what is this? And as I let the longing be there, I realised I was longing for some sort of holding or support, some kind of love, kind of mirroring or something like that. It's hard to put into words. And as I sensed that, as I knew that, a natural response of compassion came and kindness. So all that rejection and making wrong, the complete opposite. So I wasn't trying to construct this, it just came naturally, as it would for any of you, as it probably is with you listening to this story, perhaps. And then I realised, then I had this thought, oh, at least somebody's getting this, a response to this. This is probably what she feels too. At least somebody's getting this. And so instead of making her wrong and hating her, I suddenly had understanding for her and allowing for her in her humanity. And so it was no longer making whatever dynamic I assumed was happening between them wrong, either. Or judging that. And then it's just in this process, my heart just sort of settled, it almost like settled back into my own orbit. Instead of being out there and all about what was happening out there, I was sort of at peace with myself as I was, exactly as I was. And then I realized I'm giving myself what I was searching for, what I was longing for. I didn't need it from out there. I was giving myself that allowing and accepting and love, actually. And in the Buddha's teaching, the antidote, framed as antidotes, the antidote to jealousy is mudita, what's called mudita, which is translated as something like appreciative joy or sympathetic joy. But in that moment, I realized it was all a kind of movement of nature. That when you're really with something just as it is and honor it, it contains the seeds of its own antithesis. It unfolds towards completion or cessation. So a central premise of the Buddha's teaching is that all that is subject to arising is subject to ceasing, and in its passing there is peace. So there's a movement there. And sometimes, so if I'm attached to the movement, it just goes into suffering. If I let the movement be and be present with it and respond to it, it leads to peace, actually. So that's why it's useful not to reject. It's very useful. Whatever is here. And it's a skill, and it takes time to discover how to be with but not in. To not reject and not follow. It takes a skill with each unique moment we have, actually. So, I'd like to speak a bit to separating out the inner critic from the natural ability of our minds to discriminate, to separate out our experience and recognize different objects and experiences. Because the inner critic, it discriminates and then it evaluates. So it will say, this is fear, but then it will say, fear is wrong. You shouldn't be feeling fear. So that's different than certain recognizing, okay, this is the mind. So sometimes when I'm meditating, okay, I'll say to myself, oh, this is the mind affected by fear. Well, this is a mind affected by doubt. It's a bit of a kind of clunky way of doing it, but it just helps me recognize those experiences a bit more objectively as experiences. And the inner critic would be, I'm full of doubt and I'm getting it wrong and I'm losing it and what I should do to get back on track. And that kind of harps back to that model in the psychodynamic model of for children, they, you know, if you see, they are their feelings. So, you know, if you see a child and a child has a tantrum, it's totally immersed or inhabited by that emotion, isn't it? Totally. And then when it's over and they're in something else. And it's this put down or this judgment, this making wrong. It's not just about the behavior. It's like the inner critic makes us wrong for being it or experiencing it. It's wrong and we're wrong. And it's that sense of wrongness. It also gets put together with our Judeo-Christian conditioning, fundamental sin, or fundamental, you know, what's the word? Original sin. And then, is it, you know, just contemplating. So the Buddha, is a, I don't think that is actually what Jesus meant, personally, either. I was talking to a friend recently about the etymology of the word sin, and also the word dukkha, which is the Pali word for suffering. And they're similar, actually. The etymologies of both those terms, in my understanding, is similar. So the etymology for the word sin is missing the mark. Is that right? Missing the mark. And the etymology of the word dukkha, which Pali word for suffering, is drawn from the analogy. It was a practical word used for when a wheelwright made a wheel, but the wheel had lost its alignment, so it ran offline. So it's the same energy, but just in a different movement. And just like with the jealousy, there's a whole difference to acknowledging the jealousy and not adding on the personal sense that I am wrong and this is wrong, or that being added on, but that knowing that instead of being subject to that. A very big difference for me is the essential feeling of in Buddhism it's called metta, or self-love, or loving-kindness. So when something is just what it is, in my inner or outer experience, there's awareness and presence. It's like a heart. It has can have a kindness in it, a responsiveness in it. Whereas the inner critic is, there's no compassion. It's really an attacking experience, actually. And of course, I've talked a lot about it in this direction. But often how we judge others can be a real mirror of how we judge ourselves, actually. So if someone's doing something, basically I don't normally allow myself to do. It can be helpful, because then I can see. And then I can also sometimes just recognize how in my family that was just a no-go area, you know. And it all in English culture, showing off. You know, showing off is kind of, I think, generically maybe from my generation anyway, it's kind of, that's a societal inner critic topic. So another example is in our meditation practice. So we have perhaps an idea about how it would look if we were really, you know, making it in terms of meditation. I mean, after 20 years, we should be able to not be completely wandering all over the place and falling asleep, right? Or whatever. And so there's an experience of drowsiness. And what the inner critic makes of that is it's a failing. But if we just acknowledge it, that was a drowsy meditation experience, and not judge it, we can be curious about it. We can want to understand how come. So we're not making it wrong, but and honor the aspiration. We want to be present. We want to notice what's here. But if we have that gentle curiosity, we can be sensitive to, okay, maybe the reality was I've just done a month's work as a living carer. There's an accumulation of tiredness. Or I might remember a mind state came up and something in me just switched off. found it hard to go there. And one of the ways I switch off is to shut down, shut out. And that can be curious. And it's a kind of protection. So there can be understanding and compassion rather than making wrong and failing. So that's, yeah, just coming back to the meditation qualities, which are this receptivity, this inner listening, this inner attuning. And actually what comes up when we allow it can support that. So in fact the drowsiness becomes a doorway to understanding, rather than something that's just a problem to be fixed. When did I switch off? Oh yeah, I was going back to what happened yesterday, or something like that. So earlier I talked about this cycle of the narrative, you know, the thoughts going on in our head and then the associated mind state with whatever those thoughts may be and the corresponding feeling in the body. And with the inner critic, one of the ways we stay hooked with the inner critic is there can be a kernel of truth in what it is actually saying. So we separate the message from the evaluation. What's often hooking us in is there's something accurate about what it's saying. So for instance, with the drowsiness example, there's a certain truth in that recognition there was drowsiness. And when I recognize what the inner critic is saying, experience what the inner critic does, which is it's a bit like hitting a tack with a sledgehammer. You know, it's like hitting a small nail with a sledgehammer. You know, it's like there's something I want to have a shift in, like I want to be more wakeful, for instance, but the inner critic tries to motivate and coerce in an incredibly heavy-handed way. There's very little kindness in it, pretty much no flexibility in it. So when I hear that, sometimes I'll say to myself things like, would I speak to my best friend if they got drowsy? Would I speak to them like that? And actually, probably not. Probably not as rude and attacking. So it brings a kind of reality check in that way. It brings a kind of, yeah, this is not appropriate. And not only is it not appropriate, it actually doesn't work. It makes us feel like giving up rather than... So meditation becomes a chore, another thing we have to get right, rather than something that's supportive and regenerative. So it's quite a tough thing to actually face the inner critic, because it's painful. But the value of it is we start to get it a bit in perspective. So I ask myself, what am I telling myself right now? And I notice those messages about the thing, but also about me. You know, so how the child puts the two together. So what I'd like to do next is a little bit of an exploration around kindness. Around in relationship to the inner critic. So one of the aspects of the inner critic is helpful to understand is that, like in how it developed in us as children, it's actually trying to help us be socialized and belong, experience feeling accepted. But it does it by badgering us or beating us or coercing us. And actually those qualities, like, and also just what I've just described, they don't actually help us grow and develop. They don't help us attune to ourselves and connect. They just make us feel bad about ourselves. What does actually help us is loving support, giving ourselves space. So just like this morning with the meditation, just that suggestion of allowing and opening, allowing ourselves to learn through making mistakes. So letting go of some of those, or questioning some of those notions of how we should be or how we should, like at work, for instance, how we should be able to produce certain results, you know, be effective in certain ways. Sometimes we think our inner critic is actually a wise voice guiding us. You know, it kind of can be quite subtle or not, but we can think, well, what would I? How would it be without the inner critic? I might just not function very well or run riot, you know, or go let myself go and regret it enormously. But actually, you know, the inner critic is quite noisy. It's because it has all of these resonances of guilt and shame, it does a lot of stirring up of that pond I described at the beginning. It's a lot of activity. And if we can trust into letting it loosen its hold on us a bit, we begin to access another level of knowing what we need, knowing what's right in the moment. It's a kind of knowing that we all have. We know it when we pause and we really listen. It's there. But it's hard to hear it when we're dealing with the pain of the judgment.